Welcome to Red Carpet Healthcare Solutions, hosted by Dr. Ryan Mauley and Travis Buzzell. Join us on this journey as we educate the patient population, inform today's medical providers, and inspire tomorrow's medical leaders through education and in-depth discussions. We can all discover today's best healthcare solutions. Now, sit back and enjoy Red Carpet Healthcare Solutions, Private Practice Podcasters.
If you don't mind, can you just share with our guests, our audience, Travis and myself, your story, your experience with burnout and all the other stuff that goes along with that?
Yeah, I'd love to. Like I've always said, you know, like in the beginning, I loved my job. I loved operating. You know, if I was there late doing cases, it was great. You know, I loved the patients. I loved the workload. And, you know, like all of us, I just probably worked a lot more than I should have. But like all of us, what do? We keep going to work. Like you get the flu, you put on a mask and you go to work. Like you're sick, you just get up and go. So I kept going to work because I had full clinics. I had full ORs. And by Friday, I was like a zombie. And I don't know how I got through clinic that day, but I had started seeing a therapist prior to that because of dealing and struggling with burnout. And she'd always said, call. So from outside the clinic, I'd made it outside. And I remember calling her and basically just saying, I'm in trouble. And I didn't really grasp what was going on. You know, we compartmentalize and override. I mean, we're taught like you can deal with a patient in this room or this OR and all hell breaks loose and something really bad happens. And you walk out and you put on that face because you walk into the next room with a smile. Hi, how you doing? So, you know, we're taught from an early age of shut those emotions down, shut your feelings down. Don't talk about them. Don't bring them up. Just keep going. And I got home. I don't know how. You know, she said, you know, if you're suicidal, go right to the ER. And I made it home and I crawled in bed. And for about 3 weeks, I didn't leave my bed. And I couldn't talk. Like my wife would kept coming in, trying to figure out what was going on. And you know, I just couldn't verbalize anything. You know, I didn't eat. I lost like 20 pounds. It was my wife that called, you know, the office manager and was just like, look, like, Adam's not going to be there on Monday, and I don't know when he's coming back.
Yeah, everything you say, again, just resonates so deeply with me because, again, we've been through this training process, which is very, very rigorous. You know, you graduate high school, you go to 4 years of undergrad, you then go to 4 years of med school, you then do a five-year orthopedic surgery residency. You and I both then chose to do another year of fellowship. So you essentially go to 28th grade, when you're all said and done, 14 years beyond high school. And it's very much, I think, like the military, especially orthopedic surgery, whereas my program, love my program directors. One of them was, you know, a guest on my podcast and have a great relationship with him. But there was a point during my residency where I almost hung it up, quit, because I was meeting that breaking point, didn't think I could do it. And it was... I'll never forget his words, but it was like, trust no one. You don't even trust me. You need to be skeptical of everything. It's very, like you said, black and white, right? There's no shades of gray and you need to suck it up, buttercup, right? I remember I had an abscess tooth. You mentioned tooth. I've missed work twice in my entire career, including residency. One was for an abscess tooth and I was in like full blown Rigers laying on the couch on call. Felt like trigeminal neuralgia. I've never had that. Well, maybe I did. Maybe that's what that was temporarily. And the other one was when I like threw my back out lifting a heavy leg during a total knee. But every other time I've gone because I couldn't. Who's going to do it if I'm not there, right? It's, and I'm not trying to like put on this superhero costume, but like if a nurse doesn't show up or even an anesthesia doctor doesn't show up, like the show still goes on, right? Like, right. They'll bring in another anesthesia provider, but if the surgeon doesn't show up, there's no surgery happening that day.
That's what I would say. Like, there's no substitute teacher for a physician.
No.
And like, and you know too, like, even when we go away on vacation, it's not like an office job where work goes on and you come back and pick up where you left off. You get a week's worth of post-ops and pre-ops and office visits that you wind up adding before or after your
vacation. Yeah, it's catch up and emails and all that kind of stuff. So it definitely adds up. And, you know, when I read and your post and watched your YouTube kind of message, it resonated even deeper with me because I personally was going through my own phase of burnout. And it's all the other stuff, right? Again, love what I do. But it's the stresses of the job. For me, it was the stresses of owning a business and dealing with close to 35 employees and trying to make all those people happy, which it's hard to keep one or two people happy, let alone 35 people happy. And then all your patients and, you know, you do your best. And even if they don't have a massive complication, if they're just dissatisfied, like that's a loss to me. And I take that very hard. I lose a lot of sleep. It's funny you mentioned 2 a.m. because it's always the things I talk to Travis. I'm like, yep, been up since 2 a.m. Why are you up at 2 a.m.? I'm like, thinking about a patient. And it just all those things, they add up. And I think that, you know, as we're taught, we're not supposed to express our feelings. I started talking to a life coach probably about 5 years ago now. 4 or 5 years ago, and it was one of the best decisions that I ever made. I speak with her at least once every other week, sometimes once every week, for an hour, and we just touch base, and a lot of it's work-related, but there's personal stuff that we talk about too, and just she keeps me balanced. She keeps, you know, me understanding that, like, there's outlets, and the biggest thing for me was just the communication piece, because my wife would always say, Ryan, who do you talk to about all this? I'm like, what do you mean, who would I talk to about all this, right? I just sublimate it. There's no talking, right? You get up, you go to work, you do it the next day, and you keep going. And it's weak if you need to talk to somebody. That's how I was always brought up, and it couldn't be further from the truth.
Yeah, and it kind of brings up a great point, too. Like, if one of the things that I learned in behavioral therapy, they talk about these circles. And like your inner circle is like, you know, your wife or your parents or your kids, like the really, really intimate people. And then outside that ring are sort of like the really close friends, you know, outside that are just friends and then maybe work colleagues and, you know, acquaintances and strangers. And, you know, what they told us is you need people in each of those rings. And again, like, you know, my partners, I was kind of overwhelmed at when I came back, how open they were, that I had, you know, coffee and I talked to a lot of them outside of work. And what we all find is that, you know, we get busy in our careers and we have family at home and we have work at work and we work so much. Many of us don't have that core group of friends outside of that. You know, I'm talking to my partners, like most of them, like, yeah, I just kind of lost all my friends because I got kids and it's like, I leave work. I got to go to a game and, you know, I'm watching a play or a show and going on vacation. And there's no time for friends. And exactly like what you're talking about, there's no place for us to vent just the daily rigors of marriage and being a father and work and life. And that's the thing. I still kind of struggle with that, you know, because again, like all my partners are working, so they don't have, you know, talked about meeting up, but you know, most of them are busy, so there's not as much free time. And it is the one thing that I've noticed now working part-time that I'm like, holy crap. Like, you know, I see my kid off to school and people are outside exercising and jogging and there's people at the coffee shop and lunch places are packed. I'm like, my God, like, you mean like the whole world isn't at work from 6 to 6?
People are living.
That I'm just amazed that there's this life outside of healthcare that I just didn't even know it was there for the past 20 years.
Yeah. And I mean, as I'm sitting here kind of listening to this, I mean, yeah, I just wanted to say, yeah, obviously thanks for sharing. I think, you know, I personally, obviously on a much different level, you know, not a, you know, physician, but, you know, as a person who owns a business and has a family and, you know, there's this sort of stigma around, you know, mental health and, you know, particularly as it relates to like men, right? Like, you know, no, you know, don't do that. No, don't share that, or, you know, just keep that to yourself because it's your responsibility and, you know, this is sort of your duty. And, you know, and I mean, I'm sure a lot of us, like, you know, our dads are, you know, like my dad, who is, I love very much, but he's very old school. I mean, his several Howie-isms is what we call them. But I mean, don't get wet until it rains. It's like, dad, that's not good. And so, you know, I, over the last several years, have, you know, started to discover through conversations, you know, with Ryan and, you know, and close friends and people, of like little things that I'll just experience throughout, you know, the day or the month, or, you know, get hyper focused on something and it'll be like, yeah, that's called anxiety. It's like, huh? No, I don't have anxiety. That's not me. And it's like, no, it's okay. You know, it's okay sometimes to not be okay. And I just feel like, you know, from my experience, you know, talking about it and opening up about it, whether it was a shitty day or you're just not really feeling something, or, you know, you just had an overwhelming feeling of just like doom for absolutely no reason. It's like, talking about it almost makes it better, right? I mean, there's no solution to it. There's no fix, but it's like just that open communication. And, you know, for me, what I found, you know, particularly with my siblings, quite honestly, is like, holy shit, you too? That was like the light bulb that was like, oh, okay, so you're not the only one. And I know you kind of had alluded to that earlier. It's like, you know, there's obviously, certainly don't want anyone else to ever feel like that, but there is sort of some comfort in knowing that, like you said, like, you're not the only one, and it's not just you. And, you know, it, in addition to work and everything else, it's just like, man, anytime you, you know, pick up your phone or open a computer or turn on TV, it's like, there's never like the news article of the day of this amazing, great thing that happened, and look at how wonderful this is. It's like, you know, world's going to hell. There's bombs going off everywhere. It's just so negative. And it's just like, I feel like everything around us is just sort of like programmed to be controversial and chaotic. And, you know, there's all of these things. And, you know, I'm in favor, obviously, of, you know, obstacles, and, you know, and nothing's given, everything's earned. And you know, things are going to be hard and tough, and you're going to have challenges in your life. You know, and those things are different than what we're talking about. And these are just inherent things that happen. And I don't think that, you know, there's any rhyme or reason to it. And there are triggers all around us that, you know, we don't even know. And it's just something that I think most of us, you know, particularly as men, have just kind of bottled up and shoved down and, you know, just sort of, you know, take it to a place where, you know, I'll deal with it one day sort of thing. And it's like, you know, one of two things are going to happen, right? It's like, it will come for you, and there's nothing you can do. You can't outrun it, right? And so, you know, or, I mean, your health too. I mean, there's so much literature and data now and research on just like stress. And it's like, it's physical manifestation of like different things with your health. And it's like, it's crazy that we're still like, sort of, and I think it's better than it has been in the last decade, but
people are starting to talk. And I think one of the things that you mentioned briefly, I can't remember if it was before we started recording or right when you started talking about this, was let's focus on those solutions, right? So for you, you mentioned the cognitive behavioral therapy, but you also mentioned things like meditation and mindfulness and
boundaries.
Boundaries was a huge one. That was one of the big things for me that I set up that really, really helped. I think you mentioned nutrition too. Like what, let's provide some solutions, because this is such a common problem. We hear physicians are getting out of medicine at alarming rates. People are not going into medicine because of this, what they're hearing. And then the physician suicide numbers are massive. And of those, I mean, we talked about it a bit, 2.2% of physician suicides are orthopedic surgeons. So what did you find super helpful, and what do you do on a regular basis now to kind of keep balance?
Yeah. And I'll be honest with you, like, you know, I struggle with it every single day. Like even like these past 2 or 3 weeks, like I've had this like bit of a relapse and I can't pinpoint a cause. So, you know, I'm definitely far from perfect, you know, definitely kind of cycle. But what's interesting too, you know, that, you know, in orthopedics, we have sort of the highest suicide rate of specialty. But, you know, when you look at physician satisfaction, we're usually at the top, which is really scary, right? Like, we're supposed to be the group that has like the greatest jobs, but yet we wind up, you know, killing ourselves. And does that have to do with, luckily, I'm super happy to see non-white male orthopedic surgeons. Like, I'm so happy to see people of color and females in our group, but, you know, maybe it's been so predominantly male, you know, access to firearms or, you know, other reasons that, yeah, I agree with you. We definitely got to stop it. And I'll say, like, I got two plugs maybe too. So like, Pam Weibel is a doctor up in Eugene. She has been like the biggest advocate for physician suicide. She's a great website. She runs like about a lot of seminars, and I think she does like one-on-one coaching.
Eugene, Oregon.
Yeah. And the
actually, really Jay, if you could put that right here, Pam Weibel, we'll put her contact info. And one other thing I want to add, I'm sorry to interrupt, but if we could put either a QR code or a link so that people can watch Dr. Rosen's kind of YouTube that video was super powerful. But yeah, continue, Pam. And
yeah, and the other plug, which for me was incredibly helpful, I so helpful because you have a coach. So like part of this year recovery, I actually took a course and became a physician coach. And I haven't done like any one-on-one coaching with people yet, but, you know, it's like another way of being able to not only help other physicians, but it's like, I know what they went through. Like, I went through it myself. So the group that I found really helpful is called Physicians Anonymous. Doctor named Dominic Corrigan created it. And, right now they have three sessions per week, but completely anonymous and doctors where you're with like-minded people that are going through similar issues. And it's, again, it's nice camaraderie to see that you're not alone. But even in
is
the
that virtual or what's that platform look like?
Yeah, it's all on Zoom. You know, and I've met on there doctors from all over the world, like not just US doctors from all over the world, every specialty that you can think of, at different stages of their career. And it's just a great place to feel safe and to kind of vent. And it's just been an incredible sort of opportunity for me to be able to have that resource weekly. So like, you know, it's cognitive behavioral therapy. So if we back up, like I was a meditator for about 10 years before all this happened, and even took like a course to become a meditation coach. And that stopped. So like my daily meditation practice stopped prior to this episode. And, you know, I kind of see that now. That was a red flag. You know, and meditation has been around for thousands of years. And there's even been studies comparing it to like Lexapro, and showing, you know, similar kind of one-to-one equivalent, you know, like here, you can take a pill, or you can have a mindfulness practice and you're going to get similar results. So, you know, I think that's huge. And I mean, there's a lot of stuff that I did. Like even my wife said, she's like, look, you put in like so much effort this year to get better. So Jon Kabat-Zinn created the mindfulness-based stress reduction program at UMass, like I think in the 70s or 80s. And I took the 8-week course from home. And again, it just took my practice further. But what's interesting is like, he says that, you know, what's interesting is how doing nothing is actually the solution. They created that program for like all of our surgical patients that we couldn't help anymore, chronic pain patients, the back patient that's had multiple operations, or, you know, people with other illnesses, psychological or physical, where doctors basically said, I can't help you, there's nothing more. And it was the last ditch effort. And now that program is seen as instituted early, because that mindfulness-based program can actually help people early as opposed to letting things get out of control. Like we talked about this, the social interaction. So social interaction is huge, right? A lot of people, when we're depressed, we isolate. And the thing they teach over and over again is action before motivation. Nobody wants to do anything. Nobody wants to go out. Nobody wants to make that phone call or do the laundry, but like, you got to get up and do those little things. So the action portion was huge. And kind of on an aside, because you had mentioned something earlier too about like military, we're in San Diego, which is a huge military town. And I would say 90% of the patients in this program, healthcare or military.
Wow.
You know, like what that says about those two professions, you know, I kind of let people make their own conclusions, but you know, there weren't a whole lot of other people in this program. You know, there were a few that had their issues that were there for particular reasons, but when you have that many people in healthcare and the military seeking out that level of treatment, like there's an underlying issue. So nutrition for me was huge. You know, I've always eaten healthy. I've always been like a health nut, but for a while I wasn't eating at all. And I got back to eating super healthy again. Sleep was a big thing. Like I didn't sleep long before all this happened, but I got restful sleep. And in the weeks leading up to my sort of episode, you know, there were stretches where I wouldn't sleep for days. You know, and that was kind of easy when we're like 19 or 20, but you know, it's not so easy when you're 50. And sleep became like this big thing. I talked to my patients, like you and I talked about patient education. Like I have a whole handout that I would give my surgical patients on all of my tips for sleep hygiene. And, you know, then I found myself doing all of those same things to make sure that I was getting adequate sleep. And then exercise, like I wasn't exercising, getting outside. So I kind of combined the two and I just got back to hiking. You know, we have so many trails here in San Diego. So I was outside every day, getting sunlight, getting exercise. And those were kind of the big things. You know, the other issues, dealing with anxiety. So, you know, a couple little tips and tricks, you know, that we were taught, like when these panic attacks come on, was counting things. So like in the room that you're in, you might be like, okay, there's one table. Okay, there's four chairs. Okay, there's three windows. There's six people. And you start trying to distract your brain from the anxiety levels that are coming on before it's a full-blown panic attack. Or we were taught like the alphabet game. So you go, you know, A for apple, B, banana. And you can do it with animals too. And you basically go all the way up to Z or counting. And a lot of times we would count back from 100, but by threes or sevens. It's like it really, you know, makes you think and kind of distracts you from whatever the trigger is. But there's another a Buddhist monk, Mingyu Rinpoche, and he's got a place, kind of an institute called Turgor. They have a lot of great online meditation programs, like even if you're not Buddhist. But he's really open about how he had panic attacks as a young child when he was first in the monastery, where he would not leave his room for like days at a time. And he talks about becoming friends with the panic, you know, and he talks about it, the panic of the panic. So you can have a panic attack, but once you have one, sometimes the panic develops because you're afraid of the next panic attack. And he calls it the panic of the panic. And you don't even have the situation that caused the panic in the first place, but you're anticipating it, and that usually is worse. So he started saying, my heart's racing. I'm getting sweaty. I'm starting to shake. There's my panic. There's my anxiety. And starting to be mindful, and that kind of comes back to that mindfulness practice of being aware of the present moment and catching the early warning signs before things really get out of control.
And what are those? Just again, I think this is hugely educational for physicians, non-physicians. It's like if you had your top 5 to 10 warning signs, triggers of in burnout, this, that, what would that be?
Yeah, well, I think the burnout and the anxiety kind of different, you know, because I think for many of us that suffer from panic attacks and like a generalized anxiety disorder, you know, it's the fight or flight syndrome. So, you know, it's not that parasympathetic, it's that sympathetic overdrive, you know, fight, flight, or freeze, and your heart starts to race. You know, you get dry in the mouth. You know, you see pupils dilate. You know, blood goes away from your gut into your extremities, so you're ready to fight or flight. So you get butterflies in the stomach. But I think the big thing for a lot of people is like that heart racing, the butterflies in the stomach. you know, the sweatiness, the clamminess, and, you know, some people get the tremors and the shakes, just that feeling of dread. And it's trying to catch those symptoms as early as possible before that sympathetic nervous system goes into hyperdrive. I think, and it's just my opinion, but I think the burnout for many people fits more into the depression model. So I think for, you know, I was having panic attacks before work, but it was because of, I was afraid to go into a system and take care of patients without the normal support staff and team that I had and the equipment and not knowing, like, I mean, you probably went through the same thing, like, is bone cement on back order today? Like, you know, what are you going to do? And all of those things developed into a panic attack because I was so worried about what was coming even when I was at home. But I think the burnout is more the depression. So I think the changes in appetite, the change in sleep habits, the isolationism, that anhedonia, you know, and for me, that was a huge thing. Like nothing made me happy. Even like when I semi-recovered, you know, kids and I always go skiing. And, you know, I took the kids, we went on a ski vacation. I came back and told my therapist and I was like, man, I just was miserable. Like, you know, I was there with my kids and I was outside and I was doing something, but it didn't bring any of the joy that I once had, you know, and that's like full blown depression. But the other thing that I think we really have to worry about too, you know, is the substance abuse, that huge amount of burnout, huge amount of physicians, huge amount with depression, you know, is alcohol and other, you know, substance abuse. So it's watching to make sure that that doesn't get out of control, you know, because that then can affect the sleep in a negative way. So it becomes sort of that vicious cycle. And the other thing that we kind of mentioned too, you know, is the boundaries. I was always a yes man. So when I came into the practice, I was like the youngest by like 10 or 15 years. They definitely had like an older generation and they hadn't hired in a while. So as the young guy, right, you do everything. And I was excited, like, give me all the revisions, give me all the infections and dislocations. But, you know, hip fractures came in and I was trying to raise a family. I was like, yeah, you know, be at my kid's soccer game and the phone goes off. Hey, I got a hip fracture. You want to do it this afternoon? We got it on the board for 4. I'm like, yeah, perfect. I'll be there. And I was excited to like go there and operate. I came back all jazzed. But as I got older, like that became taxing and people still would come and I was like, yeah, sure, I'll do it. I didn't want to, but I did the case and I added on the patient and I stayed late and it just.
Did that create any like resentment in you?
Yeah. I mean, not so much resentment, right? Because I, you know, it's that perfectionism. Like I just kind of felt it was my duty and, you know, we're taught to like be strong. And it was like, I felt like if I said no, I was lazy or I was showing that I wasn't strong enough, that I was weak, that I couldn't handle it. So I just kept absorbing it and absorbing it and absorbing it. And, you know, luckily now we've hired a bunch of, you know, new docs that are younger than me. And it's nice because there's more than one so that they can spread the wealth. So that there's not one person that's burdened by all of that. But, you know, I've learned now to say no, to say things like, I would love to, but I can't, that I wish I could help you, but my plate is full. Thanks for thinking of me, but you know, I just can't do this now, but you know, feel free to ask me again in the future if something like this comes up. So there's kind of nice ways of going about it. And just like the anxiety things, like what I learned and what I teach people now is that you can't hear that and put that in your brain and expect to use it when the next situation comes up, because you're going to feel awkward. So like those anxiety games, like you need to practice when you're feeling fine, you know, multiple times a day. So when the panic comes up, you're like, ah, I've done this 100 times. I can do this, you know, and just practicing saying those lines, even for like mundane things at home, like even if like your wife and kids ask you to do things, you can start with that line and go, no, I'm just kidding. Let's go. But it gives you that practice. So when a colleague comes up and says, you know, hey, can you do this? You've practiced those lines and you know how to address it. And I think, you know, I think the generations have changed, right? Because like, you know, the guys that trained us, were a different breed, right? And they didn't have all the stresses that we have, right? They didn't have the C-suite issues. They didn't have the EMR issues. They didn't have the insurance issues. And they got paid like 2 to 3 times what we get paid for the job that we're doing. You know, now we have all of those things, plus we're taking care of sicker patients. And we trained, well, you probably trained after me, so you had the 80-hour work week. The 80-hour work week was towards the end of my residency. So it was like, you know, 100-hour week, 120-hour weeks. And, you know, if you went home early, you were weak and you just pushed and pushed and pushed. And I think the newer generation is coming in, and many of us for years thought they were lazy. Like, oh, what do you mean you want to go home? Oh, what do you mean you're not showing up?
It's funny that we're talking about an 80-hour work week and that's lazy. And by the way, we did, it came in while I was there, but we didn't follow those rules because it was kind of like, yeah, we're not going by that. So you're not going to report your hours. And if you do, you're never going to report anything over 80. You're just going to lie right, about it.
I think a lot of people did, like, you know, hey, we're going to work you as hard, and here, fill out these forms and just make sure that totals to 80. But you know, I think the newer generation of like the mandatory hours of like you finished and you get to go home. Many of us looked at like, hey, you know, when I was on trauma call all night, I wanted to stay because I wanted to do those cases tomorrow.
Yeah. Morning.
And these guys are lazy. They're not going to get enough education because they're off call and they get to go home and sleep. But I think they're going to have better work-life balance. I think they're coming into this practice, and I see it already with our younger guys, where I was resentful a few years back, and now I'm actually hopeful that this newest generation knows how to turn it off and say, I'm done work. Like, I'm going home. I'm going home to my family. I'm going to take care of myself and my health and my loved ones and not be tied to the job. Because that was one of the things that I'll have to send this to you too. Maybe I can put a link and maybe you can add it to the show notes. So interestingly enough, my therapist, who is awesome, her father was a surgeon. And her father wrote a op-ed piece about work-life balance. And this was like 15 years ago now. And he talked about all of the things that we're currently dealing with and how there needs to be a change. And when I read this, I was like, great. I was like, he hit the nail on the head. Like he labeled all the bullet points. And we have more than that now, and nothing has changed. So I think it's really important for us to kind of find that work-life balance now. Because there was one of the physicians that took their own life by suicide. And I kind of follow that. Like, I kind of read it, you know, both to feel bad and to recognize that other people are struggling and to remind myself not to go down that dark tunnel. But there was an article that I read, and the partner was writing this about their partner that took their own life and saying, this doctor was who we all wanted to be. Like, this was the most compassionate doctor, the one that would bend over backwards for their patients, stay late, you know, at the end of the day, call patients at home to go over things. And it was just odd to them that here's this doctor that they all wanted to emulate and seemed completely normal on the outside, but was struggling silently on the inside and then took their own life. And I think this is where it comes into that compassion fatigue that, you know, we give and give and give and give. And, you know, I kind of put this in my manuscript, like, it's the way I felt. Like, I was giving to my patients and I felt guilty for not giving more. And I came home and I gave to my wife, and I felt guilty for not giving more because I probably gave more to my kids, and I still felt guilty for not giving more. And then at the end of the day, I wanted to give to myself, but I felt selfish for doing anything by myself. And I just, toward the end, like, just felt like I was drowning and people were pushing me underwater. Like, I just didn't know where else to go. And yeah, I think
exactly,
it's a problem with our system.
Exactly how I felt even just a couple weeks ago. And I'd never heard that term, compassion fatigue, until my life coach kind of brought that up to me. And she's like, Ryan, I think some baseline depression here, but she said compassion fatigue, because it was just same thing. I'm giving to my staff. They don't appreciate it. I'm giving everything I have to my patients. And I just felt this, like, they don't appreciate it. I'm giving everything to my family. They don't appreciate it. So I became very resentful because I'm like, I'm giving, giving, giving. And I did not like the way that I felt because of my resentment. Cause I'm like, that's not me. That's not how I am. I'm not doing things for something in return, but like maybe just a little acknowledgement of what I'm doing. And so it was like this inner vicious cycle that I was playing with myself. And I wasn't taking care of myself with proper nutrition and exercise and meditation that I would routinely or regularly do before that. So I was becoming the last person on my totem pole, as opposed to just under God, the person that needed to be first and foremost. So,
yeah, it's interesting too. So there's a Buddhist retreat center up in Santa Cruz, and I went up there, and there's a pretty well known Buddhist nun named Robina Corten. I don't know if I pronounced her last name correctly, but man, she is the funniest person, because here's a Buddhist nun who's got a mouth like a truck driver. she tells it as it is. She's originally from Australia, but man, she just like tells it like it is. And you know, one of the things we were talking about, they were like, okay, the audience are like, okay, think of three people that you love. Now, I had the benefit of being in therapy, going through MBSR, going through cognitive behavioral therapy, and I was one of my three, and I was the only one in the audience. And I was like, you need to love yourself first, and don't feel selfish about it. Like, you have to put yourself first. And one of the things that I talk about a lot of times too, along those lines, and I kind of put it in my manuscript, is that if you're on an airplane and the stewardess gets up to do their spiel, there's a loss of cabin pressure. What is the first thing they tell you to do? Put your own mask on first before you help others. And it's like, it's the same thing in the real world. Like, you can't help other people if you're not well. So I've started to realize, like, and I don't feel it 100%, but I feel less selfish now doing things for myself, because I know that it makes me a better father, a better husband, a better doctor, a better partner. Making sure that I'm doing things for myself first.
It sounds so cliche, but it's so true. It's like, if you don't take care of you, you can't take care of anything else. And, you know, we've talked about it, but it's just like, if you let that go long enough, like, it will catch up to you. And it's no good obviously from a mental standpoint, from a physical standpoint, from an emotional standpoint, you know, all these different things. And, you know, I think we all have kind of experienced that. And, you know, it's one of those things where I joked around with him when we first met. He would tell me that, you know, man, have you ever gone to a movie by yourself? And I'm like, no, man, only serial killers do that. Like, no one goes to a movie on their own. But it's like, so I... for the last several years now, I've not gone to a movie yet on my own, but I'm starting to do things that I would never have maybe done by myself. And it's just in an afternoon, and it's just like a couple hours, an hour, you know, it doesn't have to be like an all day thing, but just like little slots of time that you just prioritize for you and make sure that you build that in. And it like, it makes a huge difference.
Yeah. It's so key. Yeah. Cause yeah, there's, you got to carve that time out. And I think a lot of people in the healthcare profession just like wind up waking up at 4 to, you know, go to the gym or do something, because, you know, we get the full day, and, you know, at the end of the day, you're coming home, and it's just, you know, that kind of cuts into the sleep and other things like that. But yeah, I think carving out that time, yeah, is so key no matter what you do. But it's that finding something that, you know, brings you joy and gives you that feeling of fulfillment. That's hard for a lot of people, right? Like, I mean, I even still struggle like now, like trying to find things that like really bring me joy. Like, I remember when I was younger, like I was a big adrenaline junkie. And I loved like jumping out of airplanes and rock climbing and doing stuff like that. It just brought me so much joy. It made me feel normal. It made me feel alive, you know? And then I would say like sedated by suburbia, right? Like, you get older, you get married, you get kids, you get a job, you know, it's, all of a sudden it's kind of like, okay, like, you know, what do I do? And I really envy those suburban sort of, you know, guys and ladies, you know, that have like this strong passion for some other hobby or sport, you know, and it's just like, man, I, they do all these things that make them happy, but they find time to do it. You know, and it doesn't seem like they feel guilty doing it. Maybe their spouse resents them, but I think they're probably better people for going out and doing what they love and then coming back all jazzed and alive.
Yeah, because they can give more to their spouse and to their kids and to their patients and to their partners and to their family and friends. And so, well, Adam, I just want to thank you for, again, sharing everything again tonight, but previously, and all the work that you're going to continue to do with this space, because you're, I've never seen you operate, but all the things that I've heard that you do are amazing at it. But this, I truly feel, is like a second gift that you've been given. And I know you're using it wisely because you have, and you mentioned earlier too, like you had a little relapse. I think it's important too that everybody realize that it's not like, okay, I'm cured, boom. And it's just like, because that's black and white thinking again. There are these shades of gray, and it's a spectrum, right? So we it's a roller coaster. There's highs, there's lows, and it's going to constantly change. So that's not a failure, a little setback, a little bump on the road. It's you being a human. And same with me. Like, it's not like, oh, I'm cured of my compassion fatigue, or I'm cured of my depression. That's never going to happen. I'm doing better now. And you want to continue the habits that keep you on that right track. So, but yeah. I just want to thank you again. It's been very, very, very inspiring to me.
Yeah, no, it's my pleasure. Yeah, because it's hard, right? Because like depression's like the silent disease. And I'll be honest, like, you know, coming back to work, you know, I kind of felt guilty because it was almost like, was I supposed to walk in and look miserable? It's like people felt there was a problem. Like, you know, if I laugh, you know, people are like, oh, you're not depressed. You know, so
he's faking it.
It's a weird disease. And, you know, and even like as a physician, like I was still blown away and still to this day of like the physical symptoms that I suffered from a mental disease. Like it just didn't seem like one should cause the other. So it was pretty eye opening for me. But yeah, I was really grateful that, you know, both of you guys asked me to, you know, come on and talk about it. And to be honest with you, I was a little like nervous heading up to it because I was nervous telling my story, and I wanted to because I wanted other people to feel like they're not the only one. But like each time I do it, this just seems to get easier and easier. So again, like most things I do, like whether or not it's for a patient or, you know, another doctor, I'm always like, if one person watching this like finds this to be helpful and feels better, like that was my goal. So I'm really glad that, you know, you guys asked me, and this has been a lot of fun.
Yeah. And I just thank you and ask you to share this with your followers, right? So that they can hear it again, a little different perspective, the conversation that goes back and forth. We obviously do that. And any viewers out there, hit the like button, hit the subscribe button. It's super simple. Takes you 2 seconds, and share this, because to me, as I mentioned at the beginning, this is one of the more visceral, deep, impactful podcasts that we've talked about. A lot of the other ones have been very business related, very, how do we be successful? How do we take back control? How do we increase our reimbursement? And those are all great topics, right? How do you build the brand, so to speak? Great, great topics. But if we aren't good with ourselves, like there is no, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah. No, I think, you know, of all the things that we talk about, it's just like, you know, and, you know, Dr. Rosen, I mean, for, you know, just for you, like it, I mean, it helped me. Like I really thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, and, you know, it's been, you know, my journey to sort of like accept that, you know, anxiety and these sort of things exist, and, you know, they are around and within you, and, you know, you're not unique to it, and it's okay. And so, you know, I appreciated it. And, you know, of all the things that we talk about, you know, all the stuff that sort of, you know, the white noise that's around us, it's like, this is to the forefront of, you know, in terms of importance of, you know, just conversation and communication and openness. And, you know, I'm super lucky and super blessed to have, you know, a good buddy like Ryan too, you know, that, I mean, we talk pretty much every day, you know, and I'm super lucky because I can, you know, share with him pretty much anything, you know, and do
same,
you know,
buddy.
Yeah, all the time.
Love, and, it's, and, like, and you've helped me get through my struggles and vice versa. And Adam, I mean, you personally help me. So when you're asking for that one person, I'm sitting on the other side of the computer here with a microphone and headphones, but you helped me get through that compassion fatigue just by realizing that, like, and I knew I wasn't the only person, but like when you were that open, that honest, that just, wow. I was just like, dang, that took a tremendous amount of courage for you to do that. So thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
So if people want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to kind of like reach out, see your content? Do you have a YouTube channel that you recommend, LinkedIn? How do people get in touch?
Yeah. So, I'm on LinkedIn and Twitter, just my name. The podcasts I actually haven't uploaded in a while, but my YouTube channel is the more active. I try to kind of post weekly, and then even all my, I've linked on the RSS feed, like all my old podcasts are actually on the YouTube channel. So it's just YouTube, just my name, Dr. Adam Rosen, and they can, majority of it's knee replacement related stuff. I mean, that's what, you know, we didn't even go down the whole like KAMA sort of thing.
That's topic, episode two.
But there's some hip replacement stuff, but you know, on there is my sort of confession, that, you know, which is kind of what led to this, but I even have some guided meditation, like progressive muscle relaxation, guided things, body scans. So it's interesting that, you know, the viewership, you know, I get a lot of the patients that are sort of in the hip replacement, knee replacement world. And then, you know, I get messages from other people that are completely coming to the channel for completely opposite reasons, and using those videos. So yeah, you can find all that stuff there. And yeah. And then the other plug is like the book, the knee book, Guide to the Aging Knee, you can find, you know, on Amazon and Barnes and Noble. And yeah, it's interesting because that book, you know, I designed for patients, but what I found it to be super helpful for actually, is primary care and like a lot of our ortho residents and fellows and PAs, because like in it, I dictate that algorithm that you and I have burned in our brain of like what it is, how to treat it, what are the steps. But, you know, no one gets that MSK knowledge in med school. So I'm like, okay, here's a small book, read it over the weekend, and you got Ortho 101.
Awesome. Well, I need to order that. I saw that Dr. Andrew Wickline's new book on hip and knee replacement, his whole thing's about reducing swelling and reducing pain and improving outcomes and, you know, opioid sparing and stuff like that. And I've kind of used a lot of that stuff on my own for the past 10 years or so with really, if with knee replacements in particular, you got to, you know, overcome the swelling component to it and the edema component. If you can do that, you're going to have a lot less pain, better motion, all that stuff. But that's another episode, not a tonight episode.
Knee realm, it's a whole nother can of worms.
Yeah. So thank you again.
Yeah, we really appreciate it.
And I want to thank all of our guests out there for viewing this. And Dr. Rosen, stick around for just a little bit when we're all done here. But again, encourage all the guests to hit that like button, hit the subscribe button, share with your friends, and you know, reach out to Dr. Rosen too, just so you can get a little deeper glimpse into all the other things that he does, not only for patients and patient education, but for physician education, because I think it's huge.
Awesome. Red carpet out.
As a disclaimer, this podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice. No doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of this information and the materials linked to this podcast is at the user's own risk. The content on this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice from any medical condition they have, and they should seek the assistance of their healthcare professional from any such conditions.